Welcome to another episode of Making It in Movie Making with me, Richard Fish, and today's guest, MJ Dixon.
Hello.
So this is going to be an interesting one for me because I don't know if I told you this. I think I have. Like, you making movies when I kind of gave up on making movies and got a normal job is what gave me a kick up the backside to go, I should be making movies. Because I think it was Slasher House. I saw it for sale in like CEX, and I'm just like, oh no, there's like people I know making movies. Why am I not making movies?
And then we started making movies together.
And we started making movies together.
but yeah, I mean that's very similar to what happened to me like 5 years earlier, though, is I went into Blockbuster and I picked up a film called Trash House. And it was like, I don't know what the budget was. I think it was like 20 grand or something like that. But it was shot on like an XL1 or something like that. And it was filmed like down the road in Essex. And I was like, hang on. Like, this is just like a dude who like got a camera and went and made a film and someone released it. And I was like, okay, like, that's amazing. Like, you know, I can totally do that. And so I just like that. It just completely inspired me. I was like, someone's just gone and made a film. Like, and I was like, that's all it takes. Or at least I think it was back then. I think things are a bit different now, but you know, back then the idea that I could just go and make something and then like, hopefully it would be good enough for someone to put it out on DVD. You know, just, that was a really inspiring moment for me. And so I just kind of worked toward it for the next kind of 5 years, making short films and stuff. And
I think it's interesting, like, the sort of age that you and me are, because we were kind of, I suppose, the last kids where not everyone could make a film. Like, you still had to go out and get a camera, and it was like, you know, Hi8 or VHS-C or whatever. And then mini DV came in, and that was kind of like a big thing. So like, how old were you when you really started making movies? If you know what I mean? Like the first time you were ever like doing anything?
Well, I mean, like, so I was in like I grew up in kind of an awkward spot for filmmakers, I think, because like Super 8 was dead, like, and camcorders had replaced it, you know, but the problem is that no one was using Super 8 anymore because it was just really cumbersome. You know, you had to have it processed and all that stuff. And so, like, you know, what you'd basically have is people who would buy Super 8 cameras, run a roll through it, never have it developed, and it would sit in a loft somewhere and kind of until the batteries corroded inside of it. So that was like where Super 8 was then. And then, like, VHS-C and like 8mm tapes were around then,
yeah.
But those cameras were like in 1989, you know, 1991 pounds, like about £1,000 to buy. Like, you know, you couldn't, your average family didn't just have a camcorder. And so like, I didn't have access to anything like that for my entire childhood, you know, and like, you know, every opportunity I've got, I'd be like, I really need to get a camcorder. And it was always just out of the question, you know. And over the years, like, I'd meet people who had them, but like, they were their parents. So we were, but we went to stay with my father when I was 12, 13. He lived in like a farmhouse with a few other people, and someone there had a camcorder. And we were allowed to borrow it for like 3 days to like try and make a film, mainly to keep us out of the way, you know. But I remember trying to adapt Enter the Cybernic from Sonic the Comic into a live action movie. And I think we had about £10 to spend on props and stuff. And we had like Mighty Max masks and guns and, you know, all nonsense like that. And that was my first attempt at kind of really trying to make something. But when I left school, I just kind of got involved with like local stuff. There was like people making like, you know, like crappy little slasher movies in the woods and stuff. And they go, oh, we come and be a victim or whatever. Yeah, yeah, okay. And like that just made me kind of go, oh, right, so you don't need to like have like a lot of money to go out and do this, you know. Just need to you know, you just need to kind of go out and do it, because that's what these people were doing, you know. And so I just tried to get involved as much as I could, in terms of that, because I didn't have my own equipment. Eventually I borrowed an 8mm camcorder to make like a short film, which got me into media college. And then
was that why you're still a teenager?
Pardon?
Was that why you were still a teenager?
Yeah, so this is when I was about 16, I think. And then I went to like do media studies at the local college, but that was basically you got like an hour a week with like the camera, these big VHS cameras, and then and the rest of it was like, you know, how newspapers deliver the news, or you know, like here's how to design a magazine spread, and it was all kind of stuff like that, you know. You know, let's look at the Maison Son of film noir in the turn of, you know, in the 1930s, and it was all kind of stuff like that. And I was like, no, I just want to make films. So every week, while all this was going on, I'd just be sitting going, like, so when I get this hour with the camera on Wednesday morning, I'm gonna do this. I'm like writing little scripts in my book, you know, and all this. The college I went to just had like, it was underfunded, it had bad staff, it had bad equipment, like outdated equipment. It was just not good. I mean, but essentially the one saving grace is that I did learn to edit from tape to tape there, because they had a huge old school 1995 tape deck, you know, from like an old TV station. And that was like the best thing that ever happened to me in terms of craft wise, because I learned how to edit the hardest way possible without physically cutting film and tape. Like, you know,
say that's the hardest thing, but I remember using two VHS players and like trying to copy the tape from one tape to another.
Well,
tape.
I mean, that's essentially what it was, but just a little bit more accurate than like doing it at home, I suppose. But that taught me how to edit. So the second I got hold of a digital editing suite, I was like, oh, it's just that, but without all the faffing about. So that was like the best thing that I think ever could happen to me, because I think otherwise I might have struggled to pick up editing, which is, you know, a skill within itself. I borrowed a camcorder from somebody and made like a little 2-minute black and white short action film called Jeopardy Run. And that got me a place at Media College in Newcastle, where I spent the next 2 years just learning all sorts of different things, how to make music videos, TV programs, you know, like magazine shows.
So was that like your kind of sixth form type thing?
I suppose it was. Yeah. It was a kind of like a new initiative that they'd put on, and I'd heard about it and it sounded really good. And it meant doing 2 extra years of college instead of going to university. But I found out it would also give me the grades to go to university if I completed it. And so it felt like a little bit of a no-brainer, really, was that I'd get to spend basically 2 years making stuff and then get to go to university. And so I just went and did that. And then eventually we got to make our own films for our final thesis project. And that gave me like enough grades to go to UCLan, where I met you.
I vaguely remember seeing something that I think you made before UCLan that had like special effects on it, like lightning bolts or like lightsabers or something. Am I just imagining this, or is this a real thing?
I made a thing called Pyro, about a guy who just sets things on fire. because for a long time, I just wanted to work in special effects. And I was on like a forum called, it was originally called Alam DV, but then it became FX Home. But I used to use this forum where like we'd just make like little short effects films. And like, it's really weird, because I didn't realize till years later that like the other people there were people like Freddie Wong and the Corridor Digital guys and stuff. And it was only when someone said their full name in an episode of Corridor Digital a few years ago that I was like, no way. Like the guys from the forum that I used to go on, like it was crazy. So like for a while I wanted to do like special effects stuff, so I got really into that. But my heart's always kind of been in telling stories. And so you know, that's kind of, eventually I managed to afford my own camcorder by, I just starved myself for 3 months. Like, it saved my dinner money every day when I was going to media college.
So was that mini DV, or was that still before that?
Yeah, that was I bought the cheapest mini DV camera you could at the time.
Yeah, me too.
My grandparents said to me, if you can save up half for a camera, we'll give you the other half. Nice. And because I think they thought, you'll never. You know, I was like 18, 19, you know, like, money couldn't get across the bar fast enough kind of thing. I saved up my money. And then I found they were selling, Dixon's were having a sale, and they were selling LCD flip-out screen, mini DV camcorder for 350 quid. It's the cheapest one they'd ever done. They were making a big deal of it in, you know, like the newspaper pullouts. But it was so popular that there was only one left in the country. So my granddad drove like 3 hours down to like, I can't remember, like Dorset or something like that, like to pick up this camera.
And then they
put the battery in the box. So he had to go back and pick that up as well. So eventually I ended up with my own camera, and then I was kind of unstoppable, really, because everything that had been holding me back was just, you know, was gone. And I just started making films and films and films and films and films. All terrible, but all teaching me important lessons along the way.
Okay, so let's skip ahead a bit. Post-uni, when did you first think, right, I'm going to make a feature and actually do it?
I just left uni, and I kind of looked back at everything I'd made and was like, okay, like, it's objectively not great, like, not professional, I would say. But then I was like, but why? Like, what's wrong with it? And so, like, for a long time, I just kind of sat down and looked at all my stuff and was like, why is it not really, like, what's wrong with it? Like, you know, what mistakes have I made? Like, you know, and I just picked apart my own work for ages and just tried to kind of, you know, figure out what the problems were with it. And then I made a film, the Horror Channel were doing a 2 minute Tales of Terror competition or something. I can't remember what it was called now. Like, you know, two minutes to death or something like that. I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, it's like a competition to make a 2 minute short that would be played in between like films on the Horror Channel. A writer that I knew called Paul convinced me to let him write something that we could make for this thing. And so we came up with an idea for a film called I Spy. It's like a 2 minute little horror film about, you know, a girl being terror. Like, this became my trademark. Like, young girl wakes up in a house alone, is terrorized by, you know, some
X thing,
some unseen, insidious foe, you know. We made that, you know, kind of like, we borrowed some nice equipment from the university, and just kind of made this 2 minute thing, and I edited it on my like 10-year-old like PC that needed restarting every 20 minutes to clear all the RAM, you know, like, and we made it, and it was pretty good. And I can't remember it ever screened on the Horror Channel. Like, we sent it to them and there was like a bunch of films that they've selected, but I don't know whatever happened with all that stuff. I can't remember. I also just started entering into like a bunch of other stuff. And it won the 8 Shorts. We ended it into like a competition on Dread Central. Can you remember there was a film series called 8 Films to Die For? And every year they pick like a bunch of indie films and do like a wide release for them.
I had no idea.
This series called 8 Films to Die For. And in the third year, they did a competition called 8 Shorts to Die For. And the idea was that they'd select 8 shorts to go with these films, as far as I know. One of the judges was Dee Snider from Twisted Sister. Nice. And we won, like, first place. I couldn't believe it.
Amazing.
So then we got like a lot of traction from that, really. Like in terms of like people just were like, "Oh, we really like your film." You know, it was fun. You know, it was only 2 minutes though. So, like back then, there was not a lot you could do with that apart from like kind of put it on the internet, and that's the end of the story. This is like 2008.
That I was going to say, I was wondering when it would have been, because I mean, a lot of this, I mean, obviously YouTube was a thing then, but like I remember when we were making films at first, and there was no way you could stick them online.
Oh yeah. Well, I remember in 2004, someone emailed me and said, "I saw that you've made a film. Would you like me to host it on my website so that you can share it with people?" And that was like a huge thing for ages. You know, like someone just helped me out by hosting my film so I could share it on like a web page, you know. But yeah, so YouTube, people weren't using YouTube for that then either. Like it was, you know, it was just kind of like a... we had a bit of a, like, I seem to remember you had like a time limit on it and everything back then. You couldn't put widescreen stuff on. If you did, it shrank it to like a small box in the middle. It was a real nightmare. But yeah, but the first thing we got asked was, when are you making a feature? When are you making a feature? Because, you know, a 2 minute film's all well and good, but we can't do anything with that. Make a feature, you know, we'll see what happens kind of thing. And so, I started working on something called Creepsville, which is something I'd kind of been working on the whole time while I've been at university. I think I actually submitted it as a very first draft of it in my first year of screenwriting as my final piece. And so I looked at like the advice for making like a feature film on no money, because I literally had nothing. Like, you know, I was living on like £35 a week at that point. You know, living in an attic where I couldn't stand up and kind of like, you know, surviving on very, very little in terms of kind of food, and, you know, things like that. I looked at the advice for like making a film on no money, and it was like, so like shoot in the day. So you just have natural light and, you know, kind of keep it simple. One location, two locations maximum, you know, small cast, small crew of two or three people. And I read all this list and was like, out the window. Right. So it's all set at night on the streets. And it's got like a cast of like 13, and we'll have a crew of 25 people. And, you know, it's just, I mean, none of this was intentional. It just kind of turned into that, you know, like, because it, like, initially it was a very small, but like I had like 34 locations in the end, which was just mental. Like, you know, but it was all stuff we had access to. And instead of just going, well, I'll just pick one of these places, I was like, we'll use them all. You know, so suddenly it became like this huge thing. But I was just supposed to be directing it. There was another writer I did the first draft and they were supposed to do a pass on it, but then they decided they didn't want to do it. So then I was kind of stuck with like a half written script, and I had to kind of do a huge rewrite on that to make it workable, because I was just trying to put the bare bones down, you know. And then, but yeah, I had a completely separate crew for everything else: cinematography, sound, you know, lighting, stunts, all that kind of stuff. You know, there was a different person for each job, and it was a freaking nightmare. And because it was kind of essentially my film, and there was no money involved, it was everyone just wanted to get involved in making something, and over time, just. It was like a 2 week shoot and it took 5 months. Obviously not every day, but you know, like just of pickups and reshooting stuff because of an actor didn't like a scene they'd done, because I foolishly, first time making a film, I was like, oh, we've edited this scene, and you'd show it to an actor and they'd go, I don't like my performance in that. Can we do that scene again? I was like, oh, okay. Like I want people, at least if they're working for, you know, if we're doing it for free, as a collaboration, you want people to have that kind of input. But I learned very quickly that that's a big mistake. You know, everyone gets to be a Power Ranger, but someone's got to be the Red Ranger. Otherwise, nothing gets done, you know? And so it's, so anyway, gradually, like, people just kind of got sick of making the film. Until like a year later, it was just me with like kind of half done sound, because it turned out our sound guy was terrible. Like the film wasn't fully cut. So all the pieces were kind of there, but I just didn't have the technical skill at the time to really pull it all together. But while they were editing it, the editor said to me, he said, "Oh, it's going to take about 18 months to edit it." And I thought, 18 months is ages. I can't wait 18 months to make another film.
Yeah.
So whilst the initial editing process was going on, I pulled out my old script for a film called Slasher House that I'd written in 2005. And I just went, this is like one location and like four actors. I should have probably done this first.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, well, I'll go and do this in the meantime while this is being cut and stuff. And so I just started putting that together, kind of revamping it, changing some characters around, you know. By kind of January of that year, I was like, right, this is just going into pre-production. Like, I don't care if I'm ready or not or what. Like, you know, I'm just gonna do it rather than sit and twiddle my thumbs for months waiting to see a cut of this film. I'll go and make something else in that time.
So is Slasher House still like entirely no money, just like goodwill and like getting people to volunteer? Or?
Well, so initially I wrote it in 2005, and my idea was like, you know, like a la Saw, I'll raise like £1 million and I'll make this little straight to video, you know, small horror film.
Yeah.
And that was the idea. And then like over the time I was like, well, yeah, I could probably do it for like £500,000, you know, and then £100,000, and then £50,000. And then by that January, I was like, well, look, like how much can we raise? And it was like, our producer at the time said, well, you know, I can probably raise about £4,000. And I was like, right, well, I've got like £1,000 on my August card. So that's £5,000. Like, you know, yeah. And so I bought a camera and stuff. It wasn't even my August card. It was like my girlfriend's mother's August card, I think, at the time. Oh. And she was like, well, you can use that for whatever you need. So I was like, okay. So I bought a DSLR and a nice lens and a card, you know, like a memory card. And that came to about £1,000 on an August card. And then I spent like the next year just paying that back by doing odd film jobs and stuff. And so I was like, right, we've got like about £5,000 to go and make this film. Let's go and do it.
So what were your other expenses? Did you have to pay for the location? Because didn't you get some?
So yeah, we did. So that worked. So what happened with that was we, for people who don't know, we went to another country to make it. So we went to the Isle of Man. Because we searched up and down England for like a place like that we could shoot in, and nobody would allow us. Like no one would even consider talking to us, like, for the money we had. And then I'd cast a guy called Adam Williams/Adam Dillon early on as one of the leads. And he lived on the Isle of Man. And he said, there's like an old abandoned prison, like not far from where I live. And I said, oh, cool. Like, he said, I'll go and ask if we can use that. And I said, there's a big problem there. I said, we've got about £4,000 outside of camera budget, you know, and it's the Isle of Man. And he was like, well, you know, let me go and talk to them. So he did. He went down and talked to these people in the prison. And we didn't even get to see the location. What we got was an old school circa 2009 phone video of him walking around this prison location. And basically they said, look, how long do you need? And he said, we were thinking 2 weeks to shoot, but a week to prep. So we'd said 3 weeks. And they said, right, they'll do that for $7,000. And I was like, we just don't have that. And so he said, hang on a second. So he hung up. He went away. He came back and he said, right, they said because we're students. And I was like, I'm not a student. He's like, but I am. He said, because we're students, they'll lower it to 1,500 for the 3 weeks. But we have to decide now because otherwise other people, like they used to book it for like airsoft things and things like that. Yeah. So I just went, well, it's either this or not fucking make a film.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sure. We said, yeah, okay, cool. You know, so then suddenly our budget shrinks by another $1,500 from what it was, you know, like, and so we had whatever was left over to
like,
make.
So you've got like $2,500 left, presumably to pay for everyone's transport to Isle of Man, feeding people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we'd had cast most of the film at that point, either through people we knew or, you know, through people who'd auditioned. And because it was quite a small cast, we just started being really clever about how we did it. So because we were shooting on the Isle of Man, one of the actors instantly dropped out, but it was like the best thing that could have happened because it was someone who kind of strong-armed me into getting a role. You know, like, you have to let me do it. You have to let me do it. And I'd kind of gone, no, they weren't who I'd pictured for it. But, you know, okay. So the second they found out we're on the Isle of Man, I can't commit that kind of time, you know. And I was like, excellent. Because then it meant I could go to my first choice. It was a guy who played Pumpkinface in Creepsville. And so I went to him and just said, do you want to do this role? Because he was coming anyway to work on it as like a gaffer. So I said, would you be okay playing this role as well? Like, basically, you were who I wrote it for. And he was like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So suddenly we had an actor and a crew member. And so it kind of went like that, really. So there were like three actors who were there, who were there solely for acting. But then everyone else was there. Like, so Adam, who sorted the location out, I said, well, basically, like, your crew now. Like, you know, if you're going to come, you're going to have to work on it as well, because we're going to be. So I went from having a separate cinematographer and a separate lighting person as well to, like, I'm affordable, so I can do that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll do it, you know. And so it kind of went like that, really. And then, so what we did is we just talked to the actors and basically said, look, this is what we're doing. Anyone who can pay to get themselves there, it's massively appreciated, you know, like, and to our surprise, a lot of people did.
Yeah.
Andy, who played Cleaver, was like, I'll pay for my own plane, you know, like, you know, you've been gracious enough to give me a good role. Like, you know, he says, I'll fly myself out. Eleanor, who played Red, she had contacted us briefly before that and said, you know, how much money are you? She said, I have a little bit of money I can put into it from another film I did. It was about £1,000. And I said, look, just pay your own way.
Yeah.
Don't, because she'd suggested that if she got the role, you know, she had some money to put into the film. And I said, look, I don't want to cast someone because they're putting money into a film. We want to give you the role because you're the right for the part. But if you can pay your own way, that also really helps us. But the role stands one way or the other, you know?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But yeah, she said, so she wanted a fly in. So she paid the extra for that. Well, Andy got like a ferry, I think, over in the end, you know, for like 45 quid or something like that. The big problem we had was that as a film crew with a van full of equipment, we were suddenly classed as a commercial vehicle, which was about $3,000 to get on the ferry. So we came up with a plan because there was me and four other crew members in this van with all the equipment, power tools, the fucking works, you know. And so we couldn't afford a commercial vehicle charge to get across there. But if you were in a camper van, it was like £500 just for the van, and that included everyone in it. So we came up with this huge cockamamie story that we were going out camping as old college friends to the Isle of Man to, and we were like going to document it and stuff and just kind of goof around while we were out there. And I mean, no one checked in the end, but it meant that we paid this, it's what you call it. It meant that we paid like way, way less to get on this ferry because we paid as a camper van. And then Adam met us out there. And I remember the first night, because we didn't get the keys to the location till like 9 in the morning, all of us just sleeping on the lawn outside of this prison. And it was just, but yeah, it was a hell of an experience. Like we basically built like a little house in like the admin building. So there was like a boys' room and a girls' room at first. And then like an office and like a kitchen where, and all this kind of stuff. We built like a little home, and every day, every morning at 9 o'clock, I went across to this huge prison building and we started shooting, and I finished at like 8 o'clock at night and edited everything we'd shot into the night. And we did that for like, we built for the first 5 days, we built props and decorated everything and worked out what we were doing and all that. And then, yeah, we spent 2 full weeks just shooting this film.
So then, let's give them, like, how did you sell it? How did you promote it? Like, where did that film go?
Well, so when, this is always the frustrating part. So when we'd been making Creeps film, we put a couple of trailers out of like the footage we'd shot, and we got interest from two big companies. So a subsidiary of Warner Brothers contacted us, interested in, it was like one of their kind of lower budget labels. And someone, a subsidiary of Paramount, who was doing, you know, it was kind of like during the time when Lionsgate were putting like basically very low budget horror as much out as they could. And so off the back of that, we were getting a lot of kind of interest from these big labels. And so I was like, well, if we can make fucking this film on like £5,000, we'll make a fucking mint just selling it to one of those people. But by the time we got it in the can, which was a year later because of Eleanor's schedule, not that it was her fault, it's just, she was very busy. So by the time we could shoot more stuff with her, it basically became another year until we could finish shooting there was like 15 minutes in the middle of the film that we didn't get. And so by the time we'd done that, and then I'd moved out of the old office, moved into like a new place. Everything was kind of a little bit on the air. I'd also started a career as a music video director in the middle of all this. So that was taking up a lot of my time. So by the time I got Slash House finished, 2.5 years had passed from starting shooting to finished cut. We premiered it in 2012 on Halloween night to like cast, crew and friends kind of thing locally. It went down really well. It's frustrating because it's probably my most well-known film, but it's nowhere near the quality of work that I feel like I can produce, and it's, 12 years old now as well, yeah. And it was the beginning of my career when like half the film was me just learning how focal lengths worked, and things like that. But because of this little screening and some screeners we sent out, it started picking up like a bit of a buzz. And so we got a lot of offers by January from people who wanted to release it. None of them were as big as, because we did wait to see if we got heard back from these old contacts at Warner Brothers and Paramount, but we didn't.
I guess just thinking for myself, like this is all still just pre-streaming, so that you're sending it out on spec to like DVD distribution companies, I guess.
Oh yeah, and we had DVDs printed, like, you know, like ourselves at home,
yeah,
with little cases, and they weren't even in DVD cases because they were quite hard to get hold of at the time, like, you know, so we would just put them in like CD cases with a little sleeve that we cut out, printed at home, and we, you know, with our information on it. And we were just sending these out to various companies. And eventually we heard from a lot of different people. But at that point, it was really hard to know who to trust or who was going to do a good deal. And then a company came to us and offered us about the price of the prison that it cost to shoot at the prison. Mm. And we were like, we felt quite undervalued at that point. So we said no. And at the same time, we got approached by an American company called Chemical Burn, who had like a pretty bad reputation for putting out not very good stuff. And so we were really unsure. But in the end, the UK guys came back to us and said, look, what if we offer you like a down the middle split instead? And we were like,
oh, like on percentage on profits.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so okay, yeah. Well, I mean,
we
then
talked to the people and they said, oh, you know, they seem like nice guys, you know. And we said, okay, no problem. So we signed with them, and we signed with this guy who had a bad reputation for releasing bad films. But I mean, he was self-admitting of that. But he said, well, I think your film could be our first, you know,
yeah,
half decent thing that we put out, kind of thing. And so, you know, we were like, okay, like, so we took a chance on what looked like a fucking cowboy in America and a sure bet here. And I mean, you never know how these things are going to work out. But so the film came out literally 3 months later here. After we hadn't even delivered it when we found out the actual finished film, when we found out, when we saw the cover and all that stuff. No one told us when it was coming out or anything. We just found the cover of it on a website and we were like, oh, right. Okay. Shit. I better get that stuff sent off, you know, to make sure it ends up on the DVD, because they had the film, but they didn't have any of the supplementary material. Right. So we sent all that stuff, but that came out with just Cleaver on the cover. It was like, that caused me loads of problems. But because, I mean, it was also quite a big release. Like, a lot of people bought it. You know, it was kind of front and center in a lot of shops, you know, for a good year or so after, because they did like a big Halloween sale at, what was it called? That's Entertainment.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that. It's gone bust now. But like in Preston, they had like a window display of our film at Halloween, which was just like mind blowing.
That's surreal. That's cool.
I remember Anna going in to buy copies and she had red hair at the time. And everyone assumed she was Eleanor, which was just like super weird. But the American guys kept hold of the film for like 18 months. And we thought, oh, they've done a dirty on us here. They just never planned to release it. You know what I mean? But in the meantime, also, it turned out that our UK distributor was fairly underhanded, and they'd managed to cover all of our earnings in costs and things like that. So we earned almost nothing from the film in the UK. I think we earned like less than £300. But we did use that to, because we'd start getting statements from them saying like, it's just not making any money.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, okay, well, if that's the case, why are you keeping it? We'll just have it back, thanks. And they couldn't really argue with that.
Yeah.
You know? So, because it obviously was.
Right.
you know, so, yeah, they couldn't really argue with that. So we kind of got our rights back for that quite quickly, within a couple of years. So we could at least release it ourselves. But then in America it came out, and then they paid us. Like, I mean, not loads, but I think probably over the years, we've probably made the film's budget back eventually, you know, and then that got split between everyone involved in it and all that kind of stuff. You know, so it was, If you're just surprised who you can trust, because, you know, one guy say we're straight stand-up guys, you know, we'll earn, we'll make you all the money in the world, and their plan is, and then someone will say, I don't know if it'll make anything, but, you know, we're willing to take a risk on it, kind of thing. And they'll, you know, they were the ones that, but the big thing that happened was, outside of that, was that loads of people saw it, and it suddenly had fans, like, and that was something that I'd just never even considered. There's that people would actually like it, you know, like, and like, lucky for me, I was working on a Thorn spin-off at the time and two other things that were based on that film, just because that's what I wanted to do. But I didn't think for a second that anyone would actually want to see them. You know, it was just purely for me. I thought, you know, I'll make them, and the odd person will go, oh, those two films are connected, you know, and that'll be it.
So was it right from there that you started doing crowdfunding, or did that come later? Because I know you do some stuff with that.
Well, we did a bit of crowdfunding on Slasher House just to get earn some extra money, but we didn't make a lot. I think we made about 400 quid in the end, just giving away the odd producer perk and stuff like that. You know, but we didn't really know what we were doing, to be quite honest. And it was really at a time when people were very untrusting of crowdfunding.
Yeah.
But after that, we gave it another shot. So we tried to raise $4,000 to make a film called Legacy of Thorn. We ended up raising about five and a half, I think, in the end.
Do you have any idea? I mean, I guess you do, like, how much of that was, I guess, kind of just fans of the film, like people who before that were unknown to you?
A large portion of it was someone who wanted to invest in it as a producer and be involved in it. So we raised about $1,500 over about 2 weeks, I think, which was pretty good. But we were worried that we wouldn't be on track to make it to the final thing. And then we got contacted by someone who said that they'd seen Slash House and they really liked it. You know, they'd really like to be involved, you know, as a producer. And we said, well, we're kind of really not doing that. You know, me and Anna decided she was going to step in as a producer at this point. And so we were quite happy with that dynamic.
This is someone who wanted to, like, actually be a producer, right? Not just producer.
Yeah. So they produced some other stuff and they wanted to be involved in it after seeing Slash House. They really liked Slash House. And they said, well, you know, can we get involved in this? So, but yeah, then I said, well, look, we do have producer credits on the Indigo, you know, the Kickstarter. So if you want to do that, like, that's your prerogative, but we're not doing, because after Slash House, the one thing that I always really hated was that, because the money from the film came from the producer's parents, who I knew very well. And so I always felt awful that at the time they hadn't made any money back from this film.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'd said, look, I can't in good conscience, because I had no idea that would happen. You know what I mean? Right. Like, at the time, I mean, over the years, like I say, money's come in from it. Like, you know, I'm never sure whether it's calibrated back to that investment, but, you know, I think at the time, you know, some of the crew thought that this would be very lucrative, you know, and you're always trying to curb those expectations, but it is hard, because people are going to feel how they're going to feel. So, you know, I think that, I knew at that point I couldn't in good conscience take an investment from somebody, because I knew it would be very hard for them to make it back. So I didn't want to do private investment again. So they invested via the Kickstarter, which completely protected us, completely protected them. And they understood that they didn't have, like, a financial stake in the film, but instead they had, you know, this, they were a producer, like, basically part of the production team on it. You know, and so it worked like that, but it meant that we got over our goal, and it meant we could push the film into production, which was like at some one point I thought just not going to happen, you know, and so that we were lucky, I think, in a lot of ways. But I think it's had Slush House not being on the shelves, I don't know if we would have made anywhere close to that, you know. So yeah, it was. But I really did not enjoy the experience, I can tell you that. why I've done it several more times, I can't even begin to explain.
What, making the films or promoting them?
Doing crowdfunding is just it's hell on earth.
Okay, so I've not even really tried crowdfunding because I've made essentially one film that cost about 300 quid to make, and I just paid like 300 quid to make it. And it did make the money back, but only because it cost so little to make in the first place. So, like, how? What's your approach, and like, what advice have you got for me and anyone else who's trying to fund the movies?
I mean, a big one is, like you say, try and do it with what you have. like our next film after that, because I mean, making a film with crowdfunding is just twice the work. I'll quantify that now. So because running a crowdfunder is like a 24/7 job for like however long you run it for. We've run ours for a month. I know some people have run them for 2 months. I can't imagine that. Because for a month, I'm not kidding, you're up early, earlier than everyone else, running posts. You're there all day answering questions, running posts till late at night, getting stuff ready, you know, for the next day and answering questions, blah, blah, blah. You know, quite often, like, explaining what a crowdfunder is to people for just a month. And it you really get very little sleep. Like, it's very stressful. And until you get over that line, and even then, you know, you just, like, it's an abysmal, stressful feeling. And then the worst part is that when you're done, if you are successful, you then have to go through the stress of actually making the film as well, like, afterwards. So it's, like, almost like you're fucking yourself twice, you know. So after we did Thorn, that hit home quite hard, is that I felt like I'd won, and then I was like, oh, I've got to go and make the film. And then that was really hard as well. You know what I mean? And so so we decided that we were going to do a crowd. Well, it was a complicated situation. So we had another film that we got offered funding for, but it was very seasonal. You know, it had to be shot specifically at a certain time of year. And so we'd been working toward that for the winter come November. And then at the last minute, the production on that said, we're going to put it off till next year. And I was like, oh, right. Well, you know, we've been building stuff and working on stuff since like January. And this was when September, I think, you know, everyone's taken time off work to do this kind of thing. Like, so in the meantime, I'd decided that I was going to, Adam from Slush House was coming to stay with us for a few days. And I kind of thought, all right, rather than him coming here for a few days, you know, we'll sit and watch a couple of films, go and have coffee a couple of days, you know, or whatever, have a pizza, and then he'll go back home. Nothing particularly memorable about that. I thought, let's make a film. Can I make a feature film in 3 days? And I thought, if it's really specifically written for that, I think I can.
Yeah.
So I sat down, and for years we'd been knocking backwards and forwards this film script called Hollower, which was basically like a one-room horror, you know, the kind of film that I should have started off with.
Like the kind of film was it? Like when you were saying that, can I make a film in 3 days? I'm thinking, yes, you can.
and so Initially, we'd been working on the idea of it for like something we could shoot in like a week. So I sat down and said, right, so I kind of had like a loose like outline for it, but I'd never written it down as a script. So over the next 6 days, I basically wrote this, I think, 85-page script that was two locations and all, you know, basically it could all be filmed in what I thought would be 3 days. and, yeah, so, but we didn't have any money. So I think I had about 150 quid, like, I mean, in my pocket. I'm not saying like spare, like that's the money that I had in the world. And I was like, fuck it, let's do it. in the meantime, we'd also found out that this film wasn't happening. So I was like, oh shit, we can't let like 2 weeks go to waste.
Yeah.
So you'd think the sensible thing would be go, look, let's just give ourselves 2 weeks to make this small film, you know, instead of trying to do it in 3 days. But I said, no, we'll do our 3-day film and we'll make another film in that time we have. So we've put a crowdfunder on to raise about 1,500 quid, which I'll come back to that. Big mistake. Because what I did is I'd written a script at the same time with another writer. Well, they did a first pass and then I did an overhaul of it for a film called Cleaver, Rise of the Killer Clown. And it was just because we had these two spare weeks and I was like, what can I fill that with? And that had been like a thing that we talked about with other people. You know, maybe we do a Cleaver film because the character in Sasha's was way more popular than we expected. Like he dies in like the first 10 minutes of the film because like he was like a joke character. Like yeah. I was like, what's the most cliche thing I can think of? Like a killer clown with a meat cleaver. Like, put him in and then fucking inundated with emails. When's Cleaver getting a film? And I was like,
but okay. Like, if the Halloween films have taught us anything, it's like you can kill them as many times as you want. It don't matter. They always come back.
Yeah. So so we decided to go and do a prequel to Cleaver's character and do his like kind of origin story. And we wrote a script. It was very bare bones, you know, like it was kind of set between like three or four locations, but one main location was like a babysitter in a house. You know, it was that kind of thing. Something I thought, you know, very easy to make in a few days, you know. So we put away 2 weeks to do it. I thought we can do this in 2 weeks. So we wrote that. And then I went through the script and I just wrote down all the props and stuff that we needed and location, you know, like stuff like that. I wrote it all down. And then stupidly, I just went to the internet and like priced it all up. And it came to like 1,500 quid. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, that's how much it's going to cost to make this film. Here's me being, like, mad sensible. You know, like, literally, like, going and finding the best deals I could for everything and going, right, okay, so we can do this on, like, 1,500 quid.
And this is still with, like, nobody getting paid, and this isn't accounting for, like, food and stuff like that. This is just, like, the stuff that is actually necessary for the film.
Again, we'd accounted for some food in that as well. But this was all hinging on us getting a main location for free, which we had on our last two films. And so we assumed,
yeah,
no problem. You know, this was a house. Like, so our last two locations had been a prison and a high school. So a house seemed like, you know, easy. So I did that. Anyway, went and filmed Hollower in, we ended up splitting the 3 days into 2 days. When Adam was here, and then something happened in the middle where I don't know how, Anna's sweet talking mostly. She ended up convincing Nick Vince from Hellraiser to take a role in this film.
I'm glad you said this because this was going to be my next question. Like, how do you get like horror legends involved? Because I know you've kind of made inroads.
Well, so with Nick, it was just we had a screening of one of our films at a convention and he was signing pictures and stuff there. And I've been a big fan of his character from the Hellraiser franchise for like you know, since I can remember. And so Anna just got chatting to him about us and the films and like the fact that I was a big fan of his and stuff. And then she just started chatting away about the fact at the time we were in pre-production on two films. One was a slasher film, and he went, "Oh no, not keen on those," you know. And one was like a psychological horror, and he went, "Oh, tell me more about that." And so Anna did, and he said, "That sounds really interesting. Would you send me the script?" And I was like, "Oh no, please don't make me send like horror legend that I script that I wrote in like 6 days, please." So I did, and about a week later, we got an email back saying, "I'd really like to do this," and we were like, "What? Like, oh, like okay, like," and because there was a policeman character, so one of the main characters in it, and we hadn't hadn't cast it at the time, and so we were like, we weren't expecting that. Do you know what I mean? And so he said, "But I do have a couple of changes." And I was like, "Well, that's what you get for sending a six-day script in, like, you know, to a legend." But he came back and said, "I really love it." He said, "Can I just change some of the terminology in this first scene to be a little bit more, to be a little easier to say?" And I was like, "What?
Like, that's it?"
Yeah. And I said, "You understand that it's like no budget thing, you know." We said, obviously, like if we make anything on it, you know, you can.
So did he end up doing that for free then?
We contracted him, so he has like back end.
So he gets a percentage or whatever it
is. Yeah. And it was, you know, because it was such a small film, we could afford to do a high percentage on it, you know, like because the cast is him and like two other people.
Yeah.
So, we did that. But he was very clear that I wouldn't normally do this, but I really like the script kind of thing. And so we were like, you know, and so, you know, that was like suddenly a big get, but it meant that he could not do the 3-day shoot, but he could do the week after. So then we had to, we had to basically convince our lead actor to fly back from the Isle of Man a week later to come and film the rest of this film. Yeah. And luckily, he was a big fan of Nick Vince. And so it was like a fucking no-brainer. He was like, "Yeah, all right, I'll do that." You know, so, but we had to shoot 25 pages of dialogue with Nick Vince in 7 hours.
Wow.
And fuck it, it's a good thing he's a professional.
I was going to say, I bet though, did he get there and he's just like perfect on it?
Yeah, he really did. Some of the later scenes, he'd like sometimes have his script like with his police papers, because obviously that's a lot of scene to remember for one day.
Yeah, of course.
He had it absolutely smashed, you know. And it was, you know, I think we were picking up basically at 1.2 scenes an hour. Like, you know, it was just balls to the wall, kind of. And then I forgot. So during the first 2 days and the week leading up to the Nick Vince shoot, our gaffer knocked the hard drive off the table whilst it was backing up all the footage that we'd shot.
Uh-oh.
And we lost the original footage and the backup. But we had the Nick Vince shoot coming up, and so we didn't dare tell anyone that we were going to have to reshoot this stuff. Well, we thought we might get it back,
yeah,
but we knew that worst case scenario we were going to have to go and reshoot these 2 days again, and that's what happened eventually. But our worry was we'll never get Nick Vince again, so you know, thank God it didn't happen with that footage, you know. But then weirdly, when we eventually said, "Look, we've tried to get this footage back, we couldn't, so we're going to have to reshoot it," Nick said, "Let me know when you need me." And we were like, "Oh no, yours is fine. It's just everyone else's." So, our 3-day film technically turned into a 5-day film, although only 3 days worth of the footage was ever used.
Yeah, only 3 days of work are in the finished film.
Yeah, so it still counts.
Totally counts.
But I've got to say, like, I count my blessings for the fact that it happened on that film and not any other film. Like, there's no other film that I've made so far that I could have made again like that. You know, if it had been a film that where I'd been on it for 2 weeks and that had happened, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. You'd be going, do you remember that guy who killed himself after?
That's not true though, because I know what you'd have done. You'd have like taken the stuff you'd shot and written a new script around it to like shoehorn it in.
You're absolutely right. But in the meantime, we'd also raised way too little money to make a Cleaver movie, which again, I thought it was through the first week when we ran out of money that I went, there's like a lower limit for feature films here of this length, you know, because I was convinced that without like Thorn was like a huge film, like with like, you know, 15 cast members a day at some points, like, you know, and catering for all those people and finding somewhere for them to sleep and huge props and gags and people getting torn in half. And Cleaver didn't have any of that. You know, it was basically like an homage to Halloween. So I was like, you know, we can do that on. But there, I realized at that point that if you're making any sizable film that's not like with like a couple of your friends and a couple of crew members, if you have anything more than that, there is like a lower limit for what you need to be able to do that. In terms of money, and £1,500 is not enough, or at least it certainly wasn't in that scenario. Because by the end of the first week, even feeding people, like, you know, because what happened was all the great deals that I found when we were pricing this film up suddenly didn't exist when we came to buy in props and things like that. And then suddenly, if something went wrong, you were shelling out a couple of hundred quid here, a couple of hundred quid there. Suddenly, a van we were supposed to be using didn't materialize. We were at the rent a van. I was like 300 quid of our budget suddenly out of a 1,500 quid film. You know, and then you don't even see the van in the film, but it had to be there. Do you know what I mean? Like, you couldn't get away with not having it. So it was like, it was a huge, like, I mean, that film, basically, by the end of it, we were like, how much can we save on our food budget this month? Right, okay, so we can shoot another couple of scenes at the end of this month to finish off, you know, and that's what we did for kind of about 5 months after we did the initial shoot, was just whenever we had any money is we'd get people back together that we could get and film another couple of scenes, you know.
So, like, off the back of having, how many features is it now that are out there?
Nine.
So if there's like nine films, and obviously you've got like your kind of brand with the Myco stuff, and now you've got the games and all of that as well, like, is it getting easier to sell stuff on like brand recognition? Like, are you making the budgets back, or is it still a struggle?
Now I would say that, I think so. It is quite hard to say, because it's really hard to quantify how much of our own money we put into it, because it's just a constant, like, if you know what I mean. So although we raise crowdfunding money, I would say that's usually probably about half of what we actually spend overall, you know, on getting a film from beginning to end. So before we start crowdfunding, you know, during, even afterwards, there's a lot of times when I go, like, we need this stuff, but I don't want that huge chunk to come out of the film's budget when we're on set. So where can I get that money from personally? You know, and we'll do stuff like that, you know, or Anna will go, oh, well, look, I'll pay for this, you know, as a gift to the film or whatever. And we'll do a lot of stuff like that. So it is hard to quantify, but I think, I think since we signed a deal a few years ago with a film company in the UK to release four of our films, and that was fairly lucrative for us, you know, like in terms of it meant that we got to pay everybody something for their time, like what I would say was appropriate for, you know, for the most part, for what everyone spent on the film, you know, put into the film or whatever, you know, probably on the lower end of, but I like, but you know, like what they would have been paid had we had that money to spend on that. So, yeah, you know, I think, I mean, it allowed me to do certain things like replace my editing computer that blew up while I was editing one of those films, you know, and things like that. So it has, yeah, I would say that at some point it became lucrative's not the right word, but self-sufficient, certainly. You know, like that, I know that don't spend 25 grand on making a slasher movie because it's very unlikely that I'll say that. But spend $5,000 on making a slasher movie, no problem. Like, you know, it's highly likely that I can probably make that back, you know, or somewhere close to it. But then I'm not counting my own personal investment into that. But at
is
some
that
point,
all you promoting it, or is that through your distribution deal and everything? As well?
So there's kind of two lanes, really. You can, through self-distribution, make that kind of money, but it's spread out over months to years, you know? So, and there's a lot of work involved in that. And you're kind of paying for stuff along the way. So you're paying for like production of discs and insurance and, you know, and things like that. Whilst when you sign a deal with a distributor, you have no real control over how much you're making or what you're doing or anything, but you will receive a similar amount in theory up front if they're on the level. That's but the problem is finding the cowboys, and even the people who will pay you something are probably making a lot more on the other end, and so you do have to be careful. But I do think the brand in itself, you know, especially before the pandemic, was really the thing that was attracting people, you know, because we'd built something that I think was quite unique, you know, like an interwoven series of kind of no budget.
Yeah, like the micro universe. I think another like real strength with your Brendan is like, because you've got that art background, you can make all this like really cool looking promotional stuff.
I mean, that does save me a lot of money, I'll tell you that. Right.
Yeah. So are you still doing like other kind of gun for hire video stuff, like the music videos and that, or is it just all your
own stuff?
Well,
I mean,
obviously pandemic is a problem, but
yeah. I mean, to be quite honest, yeah, we were booked up. I was just saying this today, like just before the pandemic, we were booked up for like almost a year ahead. Like, I mean, I was worried because I was like, when am I gonna have time to do anything else? Like, you know, we're going from like this to this film to Slash House 3 to this film to this music video to this music video, you know, and it was like a whole year booked out, and I thought I'm just not going to be able to stop till like, you know, February next year, and that was a bit of a terrifying thought. And then a pandemic landed, and you know, and then for people who don't know, we found out that our son had Angelman syndrome, which puts him at kind of high risk. So suddenly I was like, well, we can't do any of that stuff. Like, that's way too dangerous. Like, you know, in terms of health. And so, yeah, that's kind of, that's slowed us down a little over the last couple of years in terms of that stuff. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I was doing a handful of music videos every year. I was in a good position with that where I could really be very picky. You know, I've eaten the shit, as they say, over the years, you know, and done jobs that I really didn't want to do for almost no money, you know, because I needed to eat and survive. And but yeah, you know, we've gained a good enough reputation where, you know, our clients were a bit bigger, which meant I could do less work, and I could, people go, would you do some music? And I'll say, well, look, send me the track, tell me what you're thinking. And then if it's interesting to me, I'm happy to do it. And if not, you know, you can find someone who's better suited to it. You know, that's fine. And so that, yeah, we were in a really good position in regards to that. So, yeah. And it's good for my filmmaking, is learn different elements of your craft like that, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that, just related to that, it's funny how you've kind of been forced to stay at home all the time, and as far as I can tell, you've been teaching yourself how to make video games and like all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was like, I'm going to use this time to teach myself how to make video games. And I just could not get my head around it at all in any way. Like, because it's hard, really hard. Even when it's easy, it's hard. You know what I mean? And I spent like a year just kind of stopping and starting and trying. And then I got involved with like a developer who wanted to do a like NES style version of Slasher House 2 as a beat 'em up. And I was like, brilliant. Excellent. So I began working on that, and I offered, because I'm an artist, I said, oh, well, look, you know, I'm happy to lighten the load. I'll do some sprite work. So I started working on that. And then months just went by and I didn't hear anything. And then he just said, oh, he'd had, because of the pandemic, he was having to work extra hours, you know, and so video game designing is just out the window. Like, you know, so sorry, but them's the breaks kind of thing. Oh.
We're here.
You're still there.
I'm still here.
And, you know, he said, you know, and so I was like, so that was like months of work that just like, you know, of me thinking, oh, this is happening, even if I'm not doing it, you know. And so, yeah, then that didn't work out, which was really lucky because I nearly announced it at our like yearly online convention. And I put off, I thought, it's not, I don't have anything substantial yet, so
yeah,
I'll leave that for now. And then, yeah, and then the next year, I got talking to someone who was interested in producing a game for us, and then he came back and said, I just don't have time, I've got too many other projects on. And at that point, I was like, you know what? I can do this. I can. I know I can. And then I ended up being housebound for a week before, like, I had to go into hospital for, like, a medical procedure. So I couldn't go anywhere, like, not even for a walk or anything. And so I was like, okay, like, you're stuck here. You can't do anything. You can't go anywhere. This is it. And so I just started downloading, like, every program I could and just going, right, no, I can't figure this out. It's out of the window. God damn it. Right. Okay, I've nearly got that working. God. And it just went like that and that and that. And then finally, like one day I sat down, right? I went, right, today I'm going to make this character move backwards and forwards if it fucking kills me. And I just sat down and I put a sprite in. And after, like, I'm not kidding, like 12 hours of programming, gone the internet, researching, copying and pasting, you know, reading, trying to fucking figure this thing out. I pressed the fucking backwards and forwards button and this character slid with no motion backwards and forwards across the screen. And I was like, yes. And then it just went from there. And like every day I was like, right, today he's going to jump. He's going to jump today. And like, and it just went like that for like a week. And so by the end of the first week, I had him walking backwards and forwards, jumping, and he could pick up a coin. And I was like, oh, yes. And the power of that, like, just propelled me forward, like, into making, like, the worst programmed game of all time. Like, it was just pure, like, you know, like, mashing, like, theoretical code and, like, forum posts and stuff together and going, does that work? Does that work? Does that work? At one point, my firing mechanism was based on, like, a running mechanism, because I couldn't find how to make a firing one work, but I could make a running mechanism work. So I was just replacing the elements there. And I was like, okay, that kind of works. Like, so, but then over time, then someone said, why is the running mechanism doing that, because obviously you start talking to other programmers and saying, right, why is this not working? And they go, well, why is that a running mechanism? And they go, just change that to that, and you'll. And I'm like, all right, like, but suddenly that made sense to me after, like, you know, weeks of working on this thing. I was like, I actually understand what you mean, like, and that was a weird moment for me.
I can't tell if I'm inspired to try or terrified away from ever trying. It's somewhere in there.
I mean, it really comes down to how much time do you have?
A lot. That's the thing. And like, I do feel like I'm wasting it.
Then it's just because we were housebound and I couldn't make films. I was like, well, like, this is kind of like filmmaking, but the actors are just little pixelated knobs.
I am working, you know, like 15 hours a week. I've got no excuses.
Well, but this is it, you know, like, so yeah, I was just like, for 6 weeks, I just did nothing but like teach myself how to program this game, like, through just like insane trial and error. Like, I'd sit up all night long, just like, why is it not working? Why is it not working? But there's like a real beauty to video game programming that you don't really get with any other art form, like, or any other technical, you know, thing, is that if there's a problem, it's always your fault. Like, always, no matter what. Like, and that's really freeing. Like, something's not working. And like, if it's a camera, it's like, you know, like an electronic board's gone, or, you know, like, or like a bulb's blown in your lights, or your microphone, you know, has become dislodged or whatever. Like, they're things that you have very little control over. That's someone else's problem, someone else's fault, or an actor's being difficult or not turning up on time, or, you know, that's someone else's fault, that's someone else's problem. A special effects guy doesn't work on set because the special effects guy didn't test it before he got there or whatever. That's someone else's fault. That's all very fucking frustrating. But when you're programming games and you go, why is he not fucking jumping? Or why is he not throwing a knife when I ask him to? Or, you know, why is that boss running through a wall? And every time the answer is, because you have not done it correctly. And that's something really freeing about that, is realizing that it's always your fault. And so you have the power to fix it. Like, and that's...
I feel like I should call this episode MJ Dixon, it's always your fault.
It is. But yeah, and like, that's what I really like about it, I think, is I like... it's never anyone else's fault, it's always mine, and I can do something about that, you know what I mean? So that's good. So I designed a game based on our latest film at the time, which was Pandemonium, and yeah, I just learned, I don't want to say everything about programming, nothing about programming really, while I'm making that. I learned how not to make a game. It's like the, like, by the end of it, it was so bloated that, like, I had to really cut a lot of stuff out to make it fit into a file that I could run through an HTML, like an HTML5 file. And, like, and bear in mind, it's a game that shouldn't be any bigger than really, like, you know, the 64 kilobytes that used to be on, like, an NES cartridge. Yeah. When it's, like, over 1 gig's worth of artwork and files, because I just didn't know what I was doing, you know? So then I produced a demo for a new game based on Cleaver, which was like with Creepsville, I should have started with something simple. So what's the simple thing you should have started with? And I came up with like a single screen platformer, like Bubble Bobble kind of idea. I said, that's what you should have started with. So I decided just to go and build that, and that took me like, okay, to put the basis down for it, probably took me about hours. It took me 2 days to make like a little demo of that, and that was that.
I feel like we could spend hours going over every single film and ins and outs of technology. We could do like a bi-topic podcast where it's like, what do you say about equipment? What do you say about promotions? What do you say about editing and so on? But I guess rather than do that, I could just get you back and do another episode.
The thing with all that stuff is that, like genuinely, it's all its own thing, really.
Yeah. And it's... What's cool about your stuff is it's all, like, intentionally tied together, like, kind of low-key Marvel style, which just would be way too much brain power for me to try and work out.
Well, it's I never liked the Marvel comparison.
Sorry.
Only because, like, I came up with it about 4 years before the Marvel Cinematic Universe was even, like, considered to be a thing they'd do. But it is based on the Askew universe, the Kevin Smith shared universe, which was like a really famous shared universe at the time. And I really obviously was a big fan of Marvel Comics at the time. So the idea of like slasher villains existing in like that kind of world, you know, where they could cross over into each other's movies and stuff, a la Kevin Smith style stuff, just made loads of sense to me. And obviously Kevin Smith used to make a lot of comic references in his stuff, so that felt like a great fit. I think Jane Silent Bob Strikes Back was like the moment where I went, yeah, you could totally do this with like horror films, you know, like
I'm surprised that got away because it's got like Ben Affleck playing like three different characters, and because you've seen all the movies you like get away with it.
Well, see, that happens in my films, but that's usually because like you want to work with like reliable actors. Like with him, he's like, I want to work with Ben Affleck again because he's my friend, or you know, or whatever, or because he's a name and he'll do it, you know. But with me, it's just like I think Chloe and Will Marshall have been in like God knows how many of our films. Because they're reliable, like, and I like working with them, and so I go, do you want to come and be in this thing? And then, like, in some ways, I think people go, does that not affect your shared kind of universe thing? And I go, well, if you're looking at it from like the Marvel perspective, but I'm looking at it from, you know, they're my Ben Afflecks, you know, they're my what's he called, Jason Lee. You know, like, I bring them in, like, and have them play different characters, you know, and it's fun for me, you know, and that's the most important thing.
So what's the next one? Like, what do you have planned movie-wise?
Well, let's talk. So obviously we were a few days away from making Slaper Fool's Day 88 when the pandemic happens, which ties in directly to our next feature, which was Slash House 3, of which you play quite a major role.
Yeah, and I definitely want to do that as well, so let's like work it out so I can still do it.
Yeah, well, me and Anna talked about it this week, so we do, like, there's a plan in motion. So yeah, that's kind of like my immediate kind of aspirations is to get back to that. I do have a couple of like short films. We're doing like an anthology film with like a bunch of other people. So we're doing a segment of that. And then we're also doing another one that's based on like a video shop for some South End filmmakers. So
going so full circle back to the Clerks,
of course. Yeah,
yeah.
So the next couple of things I'm doing are like episodes for anthologies, just to kind of get my toes wet and back in the water a little bit after a couple of years. You know, we have made short films and stuff in that time, but mainly it's been me and Anna. You know, and I think Luna and Davin came down to help us on one last year. But yeah, really, it's just been me and Anna making daft little horror shorts in our house.
Are you still entering stuff into festivals?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, one big thing that the pandemic has afforded me was in 2019, just before all this happened, we we made a little short film called The Thinning Veil for Halloween that year. And because of the pandemic, I was like, oh, right. So like we're a bit, because frustratingly, like 2 weeks before the pandemic started, our latest feature came out on DVD. So then I was like, right, we don't have a feature film that like hasn't been released now. Fuck. So I was like, well, what have we got that we haven't released? And I was like, we've got this little short film that we did. But that had been kind of picking up word of mouth, a bit like gangbusters. It was just one of those little perfect storms of like something we put together quite quickly with some good actors that we knew. And like, you know, I think we filmed it in about 4 hours and it was cut within, 24, and yeah, so I said to Anna, I says, well, what do you think? Should we just start knocking this around some festivals? And it just started picking up speed from there. Like, you know, we got into one and then people started saying, oh, would you mind submitting to ours? That kind of thing. And then whenever they say, would you mind submitting to ours and we'll knock 30% off? I go, no, thank you. But if they say if it's a genuine interest in it, then I send it. And then it won best film in another festival, and then that picked up more, and then won another award and another award and another award, so that really helped it. So we ended up with something like 25 laurels or something on this little short film that we made. So I spent a good year just doing that, sending it to festivals and doing like interviews for festivals and things like that. And that really kept me busy. That's stuff that I don't usually have time to do, because usually I'm like either making a film or making a short film, or drawing a comic book or, designing something or. So then when people go, can you come and do a Q&A for like a film festival? Like, I go, I'd like to, but where am I going to fit that in? Or the very just action of going, finding these festivals, checking them out, reading their rules, making sure they're suitable, and submitting is just a huge thing. Even when it's automated on things like Film Freeway, it's still a lot of work to make sure you're submitting to the right places, in the right categories, doing, because a lot of film festivals now, especially kind of some of the more underhanded ones, they'll have like a waiver, or not a waiver, like a stipulation where if you submit, they automatically have the rights to distribute your film should they decide to. And you've got to watch out for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you have to have...
It can get expensive as well, though, can't it?
Yeah, like, well, so yeah, I have an absolute limit, and it's not much for submission fees. So I'm not allowed to spend more than $10, because it's always in dollars, for any one set of submissions. And only once a week I'm allowed to do that. Most of the time I don't even hit that threshold or anywhere close to it, because you're all, what you're looking for is festivals that are nice, who are looking to treat filmmakers well, not who want to make money off you, because that's not the
festival. I find that looking out, because it seems like there are so many, and a lot of them like are inspirational in the way that I think, I should start a film festival, because this seems like an easy way to exploit filmmakers. Like, not in a bad way, but like...
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Like, there's quite often where, like... Or I'll submit to a festival 1 year where it'll be like £3 for a submission. And then... Or I'll have just missed the deadline and it was £3 for a submission. And I'll put them on my watch list. And the next year I come back... And it's £35 for a submission. Cute. And I go, oh, they figured out that they can rip people off. Wonderful. Like, and so they go straight off my list. Like, so it's about checks and balances, really, I guess. But yeah, it's something I've had more time to do, because we haven't been doing the other big stuff. I've been able to sit down and really cultivate my kind of like festivals that I like the attitude of, essentially, which usually I didn't have time to do that. So it would really be every so often a festival would email us and go, can we have a look at you? Can we put your film on? Or, you know, can we have a look at your film? And I go, sure, as long as I don't have to pay you any money, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Fucking go right ahead. And it used to be like that. But now, you know, like, yeah, so I spent a good couple of years just, you know, finding some decent ones and submitting and, you know, just having a bit of fun really with it, you know, like, and making it a bit of a hobby in the, like, to go with my filmmaking stuff is just going, oh, well, maybe my hobby can be like, because I can't spend all my money on coffees and cake and action figures at the minute, you know, although I manage. you know, but because I wasn't, you know, throwing every penny I earned over charity shop counters every week, yeah, I was like, oh, well, you know, my little hobby can be film festivals for like a little while. So I did that. And it was quite nice.
That's good. Right. Should we finish off with you selling both of my listeners, whatever you want to sell them, like point us to your websites and your films and all that kind of stuff?
I can, and I will. I'll do it now. So yeah, if you want to check out what we're doing, we make films and short films and video games and t-shirts, and we've got some action figures coming as a prototype of Cleaver.
Oh my god, that's exciting.
It's really annoying that he's in black, so you can never see him when I show him on one of these cameras. But yeah, we've got action figures coming. Do a podcast that Mr. Fish was on recently, where we talked about Scream 2. But you can find all that at myco.co.uk, myco.co.uk. All of our stuff's there, links to all our stuff. You can play a lot of our video games now for free or for money. You know, we've got comic books there, you know, all sorts of things. Free short films. You can buy all our features there. You know, it's just, so it's a good time. It's a good time. And also, if you go to patreon.com, we do have a Patreon where we use that to fund our short form content. So doing short films and stuff. We make those directly for the Patreon. And you can subscribe to that for like £1.50 a month. And that's where we make our short stuff. Subscribers get the comics first, games first. They get play tests of the games and all that kind of stuff. They get the short films like way before everyone else, usually about a year before everyone else. What else do they get? Also, there's all sorts of good stuff. Credits on the films. You get our podcasts a month early there. At the minute, we're doing one called It's Only a Sequel. It looks at some spooky sequels to various horror franchises. You know, it's a good time. You should drop by.
Thanks. Well, it's been really good talking to you as always, and it's weird. Like, I wanted to get a few episodes under my belt before even like asking you, and then when you were like, "I'll do it," I'm like, "It is time."
Like, always, I've always got time for a chat with you, Rich.
All right, thanks for that, and everyone else, check out MJ's stuff. It's all good.